Here are four principles for living like an American. Protect freedom. Take responsibility at all times. Express gratitude for every gift and opportunity. Become a source of love. Once again, these are the times that try our souls. We must find the strength and the courage to rise up to refound America in the spirit of liberty. Welcome, my wonderful, wonderful audience. Welcome to Refounding America, Reclaiming Ourselves. Today, I'm going to have on Alex Newman. I'll tell you more about him in a minute or two, but he's a great journalist. We're going to talk about a lot of interesting things that he knows more about than most folks. And this is Brighty on TV. This is on Brighty on TV. And if you're listening to me on the radio, you are hearing a broadcast just on the radio of this Brighty on TV show. You can follow us up on brighteon.com to get all of our back shows. And on the radio, by the way, you're probably listening on PRN Live or some other source that's taking off of PRN Live. It's great to be with you again. I'm looking forward to a very interesting discussion with one of the brightest men I know. So stay with us. Well, this is Peter Breggin. I'm a psychiatrist and been a reformer my whole life. And today I'm going to be interviewing Alex Newman. He's on the picture beside me. Alex is an international journalist. He's got all kinds of affiliations. He's an investor. He's a consultant. And he has the Sentinel Report every weekday. How do people get to the Sentinel Report, Alex?
That airs first on Lindell TV, Frank's Speech, and then gets rebroadcasts on a lot of networks, including right here on Brighty on TV. It airs every Friday afternoon for people who want to watch it here. So.
Oh, that's great that you're able to get it on both.
Yep, and it goes out over several other Christian networks and online networks and Roku things, and so it gets picked
up by
networks.
Yeah, this is on Roku. We're on Roku here. Mm-hmm. Well, that's interesting. You know, I appear twice a week on the Lindell Network. First and third Monday, I'm on the air on Tamara Scott's show for a full hour with her. So I'm there twice a month. So that's probably about all I can handle right now.
Well, I'm looking forward to getting you back on my programs as soon as you have a little bit of time. You always have so much insightful commentary to offer. So thank you.
We've got some breaking news that I'll be keeping you in touch with. One of the things I thought was so important that you were very expert on, and why don't you, you know what, a good way to begin would be to tell folks about your two latest books, and then let's just find our way into some of the interesting parts of them.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that, Dr. Breggin. Now, my most recent one is this one here, Deep State, The Invisible Government Behind the Scenes. This was published about a year ago, and it is available through a number of places. If you get it on Amazon, the last time I looked, it was like $200. But if you get it from my website, true story. But if you get it from my website, libertysentinel.org, it's $12 plus shipping. I'll send you a signed copy. And then my other little bit older book is called Crimes of the Educators, How Utopians Are Using Government Schools to Destroy America's Children. And I thought I had a copy within reach, but I apparently don't. But I co-wrote that one with Dr. Samuel Blumenfeld. And it's basically the process that the predator class, as you call them, which I think is a wonderful term. I've borrowed it now for quite some time. The process that they use to turn multiple generations of Americans now into illiterates who were basically incapable of thinking for themselves, incapable of educating themselves, incapable of even picking up a simple book and reading it. This was an engineered process. It was very deliberate. They knew exactly what they were doing, and we have the proof. So.
That's really good. Thank you for plugging The Predator. You know, I don't plug my books enough. So COVID-19 and the global predators, COVID-19 and the global predators.
Actually, I have it right here.
Oh my gosh.
Brilliant.
Thank you. Thank you. And the subtitle is We Are the Prey. You can get it in America, in the United States at a reduced rate on We Are the Prey. It's a dedicated website for the book, wearetheprey.com. And you can get it online as a book, an electronic book, and as one of these books you can read. I'm so long old, not in technology. I can't remember what they call the books you can read. What are they? The
ebooks.
Ebooks. It's mm-hmm. an ebook there, and it's got a nice reader too. It's done very, very well. The book sold over 110,000 now, even though we knew we had to self-publish it, which was very unusual for us. I mean, over 20 some books, several of them co-authored with Ginger, and this is the only serious book that we knew we just couldn't get it past the censors.
Mm-hmm.
But thank you for adopting the language. We like to call them global predators because there's so many different kinds of predators. And so these are good books, folks. This is a man who has very, very good and accurate information. What do you think you'd like to talk about today out of this material?
Well, you know, I think education is the key issue all day, every day, every year, mm-hmm. and it will be for the foreseeable future until we get a handle on this. It seems like it's getting worse every day, and it is. Every day there's some new atrocity being perpetrated against our children, some new indoctrination technique or some new disgusting idea that they're teaching children, some new program for dumbing them down. But the reality is this has been a problem for generations now. And what I think people struggle to believe the most is that this was deliberate, right? There's several assumptions that allow these global mm-hmm. predators to get away with this. And the first one is, well, it's just a big accident. The reason our kids are dumb as a box of rocks, according to the government's own data, is because we somehow forgot how to teach these basic things. And of course, that's not true. The other fundamental presupposition that I think is in error is that there was some golden era of public education that was just wonderful and that things got hijacked or something. And it's obviously true. It's almost self-evidently true that education was better last year than it is this year. And it was better 20 years ago than it was this year. And it was certainly better 50 years ago than it was this year. And it was better, 80 years ago than it was 50 years ago. And that's self-evident. It was a long process. In fact, John Dewey, the creature who designed this abomination of a system, we actually reprinted one of his essays in the back of our book. It was so important. It's called The Primary Education Fetish. And what he explains in this bizarre essay, this was published in 1898, is that, we really don't need kids to be all that educated. We shouldn't be spending all this time teaching them how to read and write. What they really need, he said, is to be taught to be good little collectivists, good cogs in the machine. But he says, and this is almost a word for word quote, change must come gradually. To force it unduly would compromise its final success by favoring a violent reaction. And so we were by far the best educated people on planet Earth 100 years ago, even 150 years ago when Dewey was working his magic. And they knew that if they just came out and said, hey, we're going to dumb down your kids. We're going to stop teaching them how to read. We're going to stop teaching them the things that matter. There would have been a revolt. They would have been tarred and feathered. And so as Dewey said, change has to come gradually. So we saw this implemented over a period of generations. And now we're kind of seeing the climax where our kids are shooting each other, getting addicted to drugs, committing suicide. None of these things used to happen 50 years ago, right? Kids didn't used to shoot each other in school. Kids didn't used to hang themselves in their closets. All of this is new, and it's a direct result of what's happening in the schools.
Thank God for you. It's really true, folks, and because I went to high school in 1954. Oh my God, about 1954 to 58, I went to high school. It was very, very different then. And we actually learned some civics. When I got to Harvard, I could see things happening that made me very uncomfortable. I could see philosophy becoming a matter of tearing down all the philosophers and leaving it so relativistic, you had no grounding to work with. And I remember actually talking to the TA about it and saying, this is just tearing down the big ideas and having nothing to replace it with. And B.F. Skinner was there. He was pushing. It's very behavioristic. There's nobody home, nobody in your house. It's all give and take between the environment, and you actually don't determine much. I wrote to B.F. Skinner after both he and I were on a panel at the testifying for the House of the Senate, actually. It was the Senate, Ted Kennedy's committee in the Senate on health. And I wrote him a note, which I've lost. And just a two-line note I got back from him. And what I wrote to him, I said, I don't understand how you can take pride in your work if you don't believe you had free will and anything to do with it. And he wrote back, I don't take any pride. God, and I lost that. I was hoping to find it a couple of days ago, going through a lot of stuff. But I have not found it.
And it's a valuable piece of history right there, Dr. Bregan. And,
yes.
You know, you probably know very well, but B.F. Skinner was one of the key players in transforming what passes for education from legitimate education to, I call it kind of circus animal training, right? B.F. Skinner was a big believer that humans are really just kind of circus animals, and they should be trained in the same way with, you know, positive and negative reinforcement, just like you would teach a tiger to jump through a flaming hoop. That's how you should deal with children in the classroom. And frankly, I think there's something pretty significant that differentiates humans from tigers and mice. But I know B.F. Skinner, and you know, he was one in a long line of these guys. If you go back even further, you'll find Wilhelm Wundt over at the University of Leipzig, one of the fathers of behavioral psychology, who had a profound influence on people like John Dewey, on people like Edward Thorndike, and these people at Teachers College at Columbia University, who really built the system that we still use today, at least laid the foundation for it. They were very, very motivated to leave behind traditional notions of education, classical education, the idea that man has a soul, and that we have a mind, and that this mind should be fed, and that we should get access to not just information, but also the tools for processing information, the tools for thinking about it with historical context, and moving us toward this kind of industrial system that just cranks out obedient worker drones who will just obey the government and obey their employer without asking too many questions. You know, the behavioral psychologists were huge in this process.
Very, very big in them. It was interesting what you said about we were better educated. I think the country at the time of the War of Independence probably was more literate. I think they, except for, of course, the slaves, there were 99%, 98% literacy in the colonies. It's extraordinary. And one of the reasons for it was that everybody was expected to be able to read the Bible, to have moral discussions, to understand conduct. And the whole concept behind democracy, a constitutional, limited democracy that protected individual rights, the whole concept behind it was that the people would be moral enough to stand up for it. And people like Ben Franklin wondered whether we would be moral enough to stand up for individual rights and for freedom. And right now, we're very near just going over the edge and down into the pit on that issue.
Yeah, it's true. You know, and we found a lot of the data looking at literacy. And if you go back to the early colonies, this was way before we ever had any kind of government school system. Children were being taught to read by their mothers, by their fathers, by their older siblings, by their aunts, their uncles, their grandparents. I mean, the schools that we did have, and you know, basically every church denomination was operating a school system. So there were schools in a real sense, just not government schools. But to be able to go to one of those, you already had to know how to read, right? It was expected that when you got there, you would already be self-sufficient in being able to read, being able to do basic mathematics. These were all things that you would traditionally learn from your parents. The data that we have, I mean, it's just overwhelming how clear a picture it paints. Americans were basically universally literate at that time. You're right, with the exception of the slaves in the South. But Cities like Boston, 100% literacy rate. Cities like Philadelphia, 100% literacy rate. I mean, even out on the frontier, you know, the mountain men that were exploring westward, these people were literate, and these people were teaching their children how to read. And so if you read the letters from those days, if you look at the tests, the things that they were doing in school, it's mind-blowing the difference between what we have today and what we had then. And if you look at the data today for literacy, the federal government has actually done quite a bit of research on this. They don't publicize it too much because it would be so embarrassing. But the Boston Globe did pick up some tests from the 1990s and did an article about it. The federal government did this thing called the Adult Literacy Survey, and they classified Americans into five categories, with one being completely illiterate. I mean, you couldn't read a stop sign to save your life. Five being a very good reader, and half of America, in fact, more than half of Americans were in the bottom two categories. In other words, more than half of Americans were basically functionally illiterate. And, you know, when you realize where we came from, the whole horror of that sinks in. Teaching reading is not difficult. My wife and I have taught our children how to read. It takes 2 or 3 months if you use the correct methods and you put a little bit of effort into it. And yet here these schools have these children for 12 years. We're spending $20,000 a year, and yet we're graduating millions of high school seniors who literally cannot read the words printed on their high school diploma. Obviously, something is very wrong here.
When, remind me, and I'm sure everybody else can use some reminding too, when do we start actually having large numbers of public schools? I know that, I guess, even on the frontiers, there were little local schools, one-room schools. When does that, and these were obviously run by the community, they put their pennies into a pot and got a teacher to come in. Is that pretty much how it worked? And so they were going to be running things. And when did that change?
Yeah, it's such an interesting story, Dr. Bregan. I'm actually working on a documentary about it right now for the Epoch Times. We hope that that's going to be coming out in April, but the history is so fascinating. If you go back far enough in time, the first references I can find anywhere to the idea that government ought to educate children, you find that in ancient Greece. Plato, you know, and people think they're so sophisticated quoting Plato. The guy was a raging totalitarian, you know, philosopher king should rule over all of us, right? And he believed, hey, if we have the government train up philosopher kings to rule everyone, and then we train everybody else to submit to the rule of these philosopher kings, then everything will be quite efficient and wonderful. And of course, even many of his contemporaries realized this was absurd. The Spartans actually did experiment with government education, a fascist dictatorship where children were taken from their parents and trained up for, you know, military service and things like this. But in America, the concept of government schools really did not take root until about the mid-1800s. You know, some people look at the Puritan, the Pilgrim Bible colony in Massachusetts, the Massachusetts Bay Colony, and say, well, that was the origin of public schools. I disagree with that concept. They did pass a law in the 1640s called the Old Deluder Satan Act, and they said that because Satan wants to deceive people, and the Bible is the answer to that, we need to make sure everybody in these colonies can read. As you pointed out earlier, they didn't want Satan to deceive people. They wanted everybody literate. And so they said, hey, if you're in a town big enough, parents need to get together. And if their kids can't read, they need to hire a teacher. And that teacher should make sure that everybody is literate. But that was not anything even remotely resembling what we have today. If anything, you know, you might even look at Massachusetts as kind of like a church colony, right? It wasn't even so much a civil government in the sense of today. It was really the church and the state were one entity, and they believed that everybody needed to learn how to read. But the system that we have today, it first took root in the mind of a communist, actually, by the name of Robert Owen. He was so convinced that communism was great that he set up this crazy colony in Indiana called New Harmony. About 2 years after it started, the whole thing collapsed. They ended up having to sell off all the stuff because obviously communism is stupid, right? The idea of getting rid of private property ownership, the idea of undermining the family, none of that works in real life, right? So when he tried it, it didn't work. And he came to the conclusion that the reason it didn't work was because the government had not raised and educated these children to be good little collectivists. So I'm going to try to condense 200 years of history into just a few minutes. But he created what a whistleblower later described described as a secret society modeled on the Carbonari. We know a lot about the operations of this society because a man by the name of Orestes Brownson, who was part of it, he was actually organizing parts of New York State for this operation, eventually became a Christian, and he blew the whistle. He said, I was involved in this horrible thing. We were trying to set up a government school system, and the whole purpose of this was to destroy Christianity. So he was very open. He wrote a whole book about this, and people can still go back and read this. It's a fascinating story. He said their goal was to shift public opinion in favor of government education, and also to get men elected to the legislatures who would support the idea of a government role for education. Well, in the mid-1800s, Horace Mann comes along. Oh, and I forgot a big piece here, Dr. Bregan. So the ramblings of this guy, Robert Owen, were picked up by the Prussian ambassador. They were taken over to Prussia. And the Prussian dictator actually implemented them. And this is the first modern-day government school system we can find. And they were very clear about what the purpose was. It was to indoctrinate these children to be raised by the state and for the state so that they would offer unquestioning obedience to their dictator. And these ideas were then brought into Massachusetts by Horace Mann. He was a legislator in Massachusetts. He very strongly believed that public schools should equalize everybody. He wanted to get the Bible out of education, which he mentioned, and obviously that got shot down very quickly because that was the primary textbook. But that system eventually grew. After he was done in Massachusetts, he traveled around the country and encouraged other state legislatures to start creating public school systems. And then about 50 years later, John Dewey seized control of this budding government school system and further weaponized it. And then by about World War I, in fact, World War I was really the turning point, I would say. Government schools existed, but most Americans were still educated primarily at home. You know, some of the states had government schools that would run for, you know, 2 months out of the year, and the kids would come for a couple hours a day just for some very basic things, but nothing like what we have today. So John Dewey takes over, weaponizes the system even further, and then World War I comes along, and you have the men being shipped off to Europe to die. You have the women pushed into the factories, because the men who were in the factories are now off dying in Europe, and they said, well, what are we going to do with all these children? And that is actually the turning point in our wow. society, when most children then were in government schools.
Wow. It never ceases to amaze me to have you on, because I feel like I should be taking notes. I'm trying hard to remember things. You have so much information, but you're not lost in the details at all. You really see the big picture. You're amazing in how you grasp things and teach them to people like me and to our audience.
Well, I appreciate that. Thank you, Dr. Reagan.
That's really true. Any more thoughts? As we've got about 2 minutes left, a little more than 2 minutes on the first segment of two. Any more thoughts about education? I mean, basically, the progressives took over, and now our schools are turning out children have no idea, even in graduate school, about what American principles are like. You know, I'm in Ithaca, New York, so I get to see students from the university. And I remember having a business school student, and he'd never read Adam Smith, The Wealth of Nations, and he was finishing business school. So it's like, well, what are you doing? I thought you'd read that first. maybe first or second book you read.
Yep. And that's the norm today, Dr. Bregan, unfortunately. I actually taught high school seniors advanced economics for 12 years, and one of the many things that we did was read a significant excerpt from Adam Smith and Wealth of Nations. And, you know, it's fantastically interesting. I would encourage parents out there, you know, if you've been thinking about pulling your children out of public schools, now would be a really good time to do it. I mean, yesterday would have been better, and a year ago would have been better, but, you know, better late than never. There are so many options today for parents who want to do something different. I think homeschooling is the gold standard for those who can do it. It's a lot easier to do it than the public school establishment wants you to think. There's nobody more qualified than you to teach your children, because you love your children more than anybody else. And that is the most important ingredient in a good education. Homeschool students do better on every metric, academic, social, everything than the kids in government schools. But there's also really good private schools. There are wonderful co-ops and homeschool communities popping up all over the country. So, you know, I can't encourage people strongly enough to retake that responsibility from the government and make sure your children get a good education.
I'm for that 100%, and absolutely back that. I never thought I would ever say that, until the very recent years of finally grasping just how corroded our schools have been. Alex Newman, we'll be back in a minute, and I think I have some questions, maybe on a new subject that might be very stimulating, that's just beginning to be talked about. Well, welcome back to Reclaiming Ourselves. That's the subtitle, and Refounding America. And we're really talking about these things today. And I told you that Alex is an amazing person, and I dropped the subject on him. I promised you an unusual subject, but it's becoming very interesting right now. And I dropped it on him, and within a minute or two, he was telling me things I didn't know. So let's go with the subject. And the subject is this. With the coming hopeful change in the House and in the Senate, it will be possible to hold committee hearings. It will be possible to investigate what has been going on. And then if we have a conservative or nearly conservative victory for the presidency in 2 years, we'll have a chance for it to become a big deal. But we might actually be able to investigate the people who are really responsible for a lot of misery and death in the world today around COVID-19. And related subjects. And I mentioned this to Alex, and he was up on the latest Atlantic article that I'd been looking at. So should we prosecute, or should we give amnesty, or should we let people come like they supposedly did in South Africa, confess their sins, and then go and join the society? What are you thinking, sir?
Yeah, you know, there's a time and a place for amnesties. You know, after a country gets out of a civil war, you know, it's maybe not the best thing, but sometimes it's the only thing that can get a nation back together. It's the only thing that can bring mm-hmm. peace. It's the only thing that can cause people to lay down their weapons. That's not what we're facing today. What we're facing today is a group of vicious criminals who deprived millions, maybe over 100 million Americans of some of their most fundamental rights. And I mean, if you don't think deciding what's going to be injected into your body is one of your most fundamental rights, I don't know what to tell you. I mean, it's the most basic thing, that I own my body. I will control what happens to my body. I will look after the well-being of my children. And so when you have these authoritarians, these totalitarians publicly shrieking on television that we shouldn't be allowed to go out of our houses, that we should be placed in concentration camps, that we should be injected with stuff against our will, and when you actually mandate those things as government policy, that's not a difference of opinion. That's a crime. It's a very serious crime. That's been established as a crime. I mean, you can go back to the Nuremberg trials, and I have some issues with the way the Nuremberg trials were conducted. Right. But all that aside, you know, following orders is not an excuse, and especially if you're the one implementing the policy, you took an oath to uphold and defend the Constitution of the United States. And if you're at a state level, then you also took an oath to uphold the Constitution of your state. None of our state constitutions, and certainly not our federal constitution, allow for this kind of totalitarian behavior. And I think the only way to avoid something like this in the future, Dr. Bregan, is for there to be a very, very serious accountability. There needs to be justice here. You know, if you were a useful idiot and you got deceived, that's one thing. But if you were high up enough to understand what was going on and you were deliberately infringing on the God-given rights of Americans, you need to be punished. You need to be held accountable. And that will send a message to future generations that this type of lawlessness, this type of criminal behavior will be punished and it will not be tolerated.
How would you go about it?
I think we really do need a select committee in Congress run by people who have credibility, right? And that's going to exclude most of the COVID totalitarians. And I mean, it should include people like you, you know, people with significant credentials, people who've worked in the medical field, people who have some understanding of law. And, you know, I've interviewed a lot of people who are in this field who I think would be good candidates for this. But I think we really do need to have a committee that looks at all of this. who knew what and when. And I don't mean just, you know, let some lower level fall guys fall on their sword. You and I talked a little bit before we went on about Dr. Fauci. You know, yeah, he's a key player, but there are people much higher up the food chain than Dr. Fauci. Bill Gates, the non-doctor, he'd be a very good person to look at. The World Economic Forum. I'd go investigate everybody who was involved in Event 201. Who knew what and when? I would look at the Rockefeller Foundation. How did they have this 2010 report and the lockstep scenario? I'd go back and investigate all of that. We need to find out for sure where this came from. Now, the Senate Committee on the Environment and Public Works just came out recently and put out their preliminary report saying that this thing almost certainly came out of a laboratory. And so all of these are different angles that I think need to be investigated by competent criminal investigators, people who don't have conflicts of interest. And I think if we get a Republican-controlled Congress after this election, that might be a very good place to start. But I also think we need state-level prosecutions. The federal government has shown that it is way too corrupt to handle these types of tasks. Even the Republican leadership in Congress, Mitch McConnell and Kevin McCarthy. So we need state AGs to be looking
into
this.
They need to be investigated. McConnell, all the money he's getting from his Chinese relatives.
Absolutely. Yep. Elaine Chao. You know, the Wall Street Journal came out and they were making huge money. Mitch McConnell, right before Mitch McConnell would make some big announcement that was going to move the markets, Elaine Chao would be over there trading hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of stock. It's a giant crime syndicate up in Washington, D.C. So I do think we need some outside people with real credentials, with real credibility need to come in. And so, you know, in addition to this committee, I think we need state and local prosecutions. And I've been advocating this for years now, and some very significant legal scholars have also talked about this. Just in the last few weeks, I've spoken to several state AGs about what the banks are doing. But, you know, the Atlantic article makes the argument that we just need to let this all be in the past, right? We didn't know what was happening, so we just need a general amnesty. I think that's preposterous, right? Just like we didn't let the Nazis get away, just like we should not have let the Soviet communists get away when the Soviet Union fell, we need to make sure that the totalitarians that tried to use this as a pretext to enslave humanity, enrich themselves, and destroy countless lives, they need to all be held accountable.
What are you doing about banks? That's interesting.
Well, I've been doing several articles on this subject where state AGs are starting to push back on some of these things. And I wish they had done this more vigorously during COVID. I am excited that they're working on this when it relates to the banks. Just last week, I had an article published in the Epoch Times, major article about a coalition of 19 state attorneys general is now investigating the six biggest banks in the United States. Citibank, Goldman Sachs, JP Morgan, Chase, Wells Fargo, all these big guys. For a collusion with the United Nations, all these banks have joined this thing called the Net Zero Financial Alliance. It's a Wow. UN organization. And Yeah. All these banks have pledged to totally divest from our energy systems, from many of our agricultural systems, in a way that is going to absolutely decimate the economy of our nation. And so these state attorneys general are investigating. And a couple months before that, they started going after BlackRock, the largest asset manager on the planet with about $10 trillion for their efforts, again, to undermine our economy, for their not taking seriously their fiduciary obligation to their clients, to their investors, to their shareholders. In many cases, these states themselves have hundreds of millions, in many cases, billions of dollars invested with BlackRock. And yet BlackRock's wasting all this money on, you know, climate change stuff and woke stuff. So it's encouraging to see these state AGs getting a backbone and doing something about this. I think they should show the same kind of backbone when it comes to the COVID stuff. You know, and this is, I think, even more serious than the things that the banks are involved in right now. These are things that cannot be allowed to stand.
I was listening you say about the banks, but what is that? How it's more serious than the banks themselves? I didn't
That's the COVID tyranny that they tried to do. And you talked about this in your book, Dr. Brain. Yeah. They are planning to do this again, right? It's not like, that phase is past and we can all just get on with our lives. No. These same global predators fully intend to use the same tactics and the same excuses again if we let them do it. The way to head that off at the pass is to make sure everybody who knowingly and willfully violated the law, violated the rights of their federal of their fellow citizens, is punished to the fullest extent of the law.
You're brave, and you're right, both. The banks are very interesting. I've been struggling now and reading books and thinking. That was, as someone pointed out, who was into finance and all, it's the weakest part of our book, COVID-19 and the Global Predators, is I only mention the banks. I don't really talk about them. And boy, they're hard to write about. And I'm looking now at what you're saying, all the banks you mentioned, the Citibank and all those, they're all the private layer. And then, let's see if I'm right about this, then you get the central banks. Mm-hmm. And the central banks are actually private, but yep. They're like monopolies granted by the federal government to these banks to do amazing things like print money and give it away to their friends. Yep. That's not an exaggeration.
That's right. It sounds crazy, but it's what's actually happening.
Yeah, I'm starting to try to write this stuff down, and it sounds crazy. So yep. You get the Fed. And the Fed is set up by rich, fat bankers and financial and industrial people who wanted to guarantee that they could weather whatever economic disaster they created right. along the way. Is that crazy?
That's exactly what's going on.
Isn't that I've never talked about this stuff so public. I'm sort of been puzzling and trying to write about it. So then they have a bank called, I guess, the BIS, which is the head of all and the mother of all the central banks, who are also the mother of all the big private banks, because they're all relating to each other. And at this top of this BIS, which is located in Switzerland, I think, is utter secrecy. Yep. When they were set up as private organization, big as to represent all the central banks, and this goes back a long way, they declared that they were separate from the judicial systems of any world or national organization, and that they were a thing unto themselves, and none of their people would even pay taxes. I mean, this is yep. really amazing. I think, all right, so that's there, and then we go from there to the World Bank, and we go to the International Monetary thing, and we go to the World Trade Organization, and we have, they all have immunity, they all have secrecy, and they just all go about their business bilking the world. Is yep. that crazy, sir?
It sounds utterly crazy, and yet it is true in every single respect. Okay. I've actually got a book behind me, Dr. Bregan. It's called Tragedy and Hope. It's written by Carol Quigley. He was Bill Clinton's mentor. He was a history professor at Georgetown University. And one of the really interesting things about the book is he's, you know, the people that you call the global predators, he says, hey, I've been close to them for decades, and I agree with most of their objectives. They let me examine their paper, their secret papers for a few years. And he says, I agree with them. My chief difference of opinion is that they want to be secret, and I think they ought to be known. So he writes this book, and he kind of spills the beans. And here's what he says about exactly what you were just talking about. I'm going to actually read this word for word from his book. This was published in 1966. The powers of financial capitalism had another far-reaching aim, nothing less than to create a world system of financial control in private hands, able to dominate the political system of each country and the economy of the world as a whole. He says this system was to be controlled in a feudalist fashion by the central banks of the world, acting in concert by secret agreements arrived at in frequent meetings and conferences. He goes on to say that the apex of this system was to be the Bank for International Settlements in Basel, Switzerland, a private bank owned and controlled by the world's central banks, which were themselves private corporations. He says that each central bank sought to dominate its government by its ability to control treasury loans, to manipulate foreign exchanges, to influence the level of economic activity in the country, and to influence cooperative politicians by subsequent economic rewards in the business world. And that's exactly what we're seeing. In fact, right now, everybody's started finally noticing that they are planning to phase out cash and move us toward central yeah. bank digital currencies. Well, it's the Bank for International Settlements that's leading that push, and they are very open about the fact that this will lead to total control of the individual. You can't buy or sell anything without their permission, without a permanent record being created. Yes. So this is bad news, these people, and you are absolutely right to hit right there. The central banks and the Bank for International Settlements are right at the center of the problem that we're dealing with.
Wow. This is interesting. This is fascinating. I'd love to, let me grab a little note here, and excuse me, folks, with the side of my head. and get that book. And what page is that quote on? I could start the chapter that I'm puzzling over with that.
Let's see. I don't have the page number in front of me, but it's a fascinating book, and there's so much in there that's just absolutely explosive. He actually goes through the history of this. He traces it back to Cecil Rhodes. In fact, I think it goes back much before Cecil Rhodes, but he points to Cecil Rhodes. When he died, he, in his will, he left this setup to create a secret society with secret societies around it. He called them the round table groups, and Carol Quigley gets into that quite extensively, and he says that the goal was really to create a one world system, kind of modeled on the British Empire model, but in their hands, right, with them in total control of everything. It's an incredibly interesting book, and it talks about many other subjects as well, but for people who have the patience to read a very thick book, it's over 1,000 pages. It's very rewarding because you get such a candid discussion of this from a guy who generally agrees with the objectives, who just kind of lays them all out in black and white on the page.
It's Carol Quigley.
Yep, C-A-R-O-L-L. And then Quigley is Q-U-I-G-L-E-Y. And his globalist predator buddies were very upset when he published this book. In fact, they had the publisher destroy the plates. But it is still in print. You can get copies now because
What's the name of the book again?
It's called Tragedy and Hope, A History of the World in Our Time.
Thank you.
Yep, and he did another excellent one as well, The Anglo-American Establishment, where he gets into some more details on who these people are and what they want. And, you know, again, he comes at this from the perspective of somebody who supports it. I obviously do not support it, but you'll get a lot of interesting details from this man who, by his own admission, was very close to these people for decades and even had the opportunity to examine their secret papers for a number of years.
It's so interesting because another one of the things that I kept discovering was that whether you were for or against the banks, you admitted they were soaking the taxpayers, consumers of the world, and that wasn't quite right. And the people who were for the banks would say, we got to improve the system. Yep. And other people would say, we have to abolish it. There's no reason to have it. It's an empire.
Yeah. The story of how we got the Federal Reserve is so interesting, too. Probably the most important book on this was written by my friend G. Edward Griffin. It's called The Creature from Jekyll Island.
And I call him my friend, too, but he's probably more of a friend to you.
He's a wonderful man, and you know he's been studying these things for many decades. And so we've actually gone to Jekyll Island several times, and you can see the government has signs there that says, this is the room where the secret meeting of bankers took place, where they came up with what eventually became the Federal Reserve Act. So,
oh my gosh.
Yep.
We love him, too, and he has this big meeting every year, I guess. 1,000 people or so come to it. Have you
been
to
the Red Pill Expo. Yep. Well, I will be there in a couple weeks, in a couple days.
Ah, well, the last year's one they had me speak at. I guess I'm missing this year's one. And we donated 1,000 books to them. That's how much we of our COVID-19 global predators to be distributed at the last year's meeting.
Oh, that's so awesome. Yeah, I've been working very closely with Ed on these Red Pill Expos from the start. I'm actually on his board for Freedom Force International, which oversees all
these experts. Well, tell him. I wish he'd invited me to talk again. I got more to say.
I will definitely do that, and we'll definitely get you to the next one, because what you have to say is so important, Dr. Bregan. This one's going to be fun, too. We're going to have Del Bigtree there. We'll have Dr. David Martin. We'll have Sheriff Richard Mack. We will have some really extraordinary people there. Talking about all these different things. You know, I'll be talking about the crises that the global predators are preparing for us now to beat us into submission. But there's going to be a lot of good things on the agenda for anyone who's within driving distance of Salt Lake City. You should try to make it out.
Yeah, he made a real exception with me. He let me do it by video. And because even before COVID, I was instructed not to travel anymore. And I've been feeling it's just been very healthy since I stopped traveling. golly, it's so interesting to talk to you.
Well, the feeling is mutual, Dr. Bregan. So
we have 3 minutes left. I want to just keep engaging you and not sort of finish off with anything of my own. How do you think we're doing right now? What do you think is going to happen in the next few months, year or so?
Well, there's a lot of things I think that are encouraging. I think we're seeing an unprecedented awakening of people, not just in the United States, but all over the world. The rate at which people are waking up, it's happening so fast that the global predators now realize, you know, it's now or never. They're going to have to shut down the internet. They're going to have to just delete all of us or take other drastic measures. So I think there's a lot to be encouraged by, but I think with all that in mind, we need to recognize that these criminals, and they are criminals, yes. They're not just going to say, oh, I guess people woke up. Okay, we'll just let you be free now. Yeah. They're planning a food crisis for us. They're planning a currency crisis. They're planning an energy crisis. In about 2 weeks, I'll be headed over to Egypt for the UN COP27, where they're going to solve climate change for the 27th time, always at a exotic resort destination so they can fly in with their private jets. So they've got, the totalitarians have big plans, but I think there's so much to be encouraged by, Dr. Bregan, because people are waking up. You know, I think people who are putting their hope in Republicans winning the midterms, that's not where our hope should come from. You know, we talked a little bit about Mitch McConnell and Kevin McCarthy. You know, these guys are not going to save us. It's very obvious. But there will be some very good Republicans who are going to be elected. And I think this needs to be seen as a start, right? We're starting now to turn the tide. We've got a long way to go. It took us generations to get in this mess. It's going to take generations to get out of it if we ever do. But be aware, because they're preparing multiple crises to send our way. And, you know, don't fall for the stuff. It's not your neighbor. It's not, you know, don't get stuck in the two-party trap. This is so much bigger than that. You need to get a copy of Dr. Bregan's book and read about the global predator class if you want to really understand what's going on and how we get ourselves out of this.
Well, thank you so much. I think I should be so much more in touch with you. I'd be so much smarter. I'd know a lot more.
Well, I'd be smart from listening more often to you. So I appreciate so much all that you do, Dr. Bregan. And your book is fantastic. And I can't wait to get you back on my programs as well.
Good. And we're working on a new book where we're trying to really, really focus even deeper on the global predators. But it's going to be a while. I mean, although you inspired me today when I told you these outlandish things about the banks that I'd finally concluded. And you said, it's absolutely right. And you've been studying them. And you know Ed Griffin, who is the deep guru of the banking. I mean, he's so amazing.
Yeah.
Well, thank you much. And folks, my wonderful, wonderful listeners, my audience out there, thank you for listening to this stuff. Thanks for taking it seriously. The world is seriously in need of your understanding and your activities for freedom. Thank you. Thank you.